ISIS was largely defeated in Syria years ago, but thousands of suspected Islamic State sympathizers remain in detention there with no criminal charges and no way out.
It's like a Guantanamo on an epic scale.
Today on The World, the remnants of ISIS. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also ahead, doctors in Kenya are on strike and getting blamed.
The doctors are therefore insensitive to the suffering and plight of the vulnerable Kenyans in dire need of health services.
But doctors say it's the government that deserves the blame.
And the U.S.'s top diplomat is in China facing mission impossible.
I think the reason that things are so scratchy and turbulent between the Americans and the Chinese is that it is now very, very clear that they have mutually incompatible ambitions.
That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us today. The top U.S. diplomat, Antony Blinken, is in China for a 3-day visit aimed at easing tensions between the two countries. It marks the first trip to the People's Republic by U.S. Secretary of State since 2018. In recent months, the perennially complex relationship between the two countries seemed to be on the mend. Still, there are no shortages of serious challenges ahead.
Beijing is angry with the Biden administration over a new $8 billion aid package for Taiwan. Just ahead, we'll hear about serious tensions in the South China Sea. But first, Blinken's mission to China. I spoke this morning with David Rennie, the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist, about the most contentious issues getting in the way of improving the relationship.
In recent years, we've seen America much more willing to send quite a lot of weaponry to Taiwan. There's this idea that American military talk about making the island of Taiwan into a porcupine, just too spiny and difficult to attack. But of course, China hates that. And then you also mentioned the tensions in the South China Sea. And there's a treaty ally. America has a defense treaty with the Philippines. The Chinese are bullying the Philippines Navy down there, trying to stop them supplying this very remote lookout on a disputed reef.
And what about the other main point, ties with Russia?
Yeah, we've seen the Americans going public in the last couple of weeks with the fact that American intelligence is tracking very, very large sales of so-called dual-use items, so the kind of the microelectronics that Russia desperately needs to make ballistic missiles, or the engines that Russia needs to make drones that are used to attack in Ukraine. And so the argument to the Americans is that Western sanctions are being hollowed out by Chinese dual-use components being sold to Russia in really huge numbers, which explain why Russia's defense industry is up and running in a way that the sanctions were supposed to have choked off. And Antony Blinken is, we're told, going to tell the Chinese that if they keep this up, then there are some very, very severe sanctions involving things like sanctioning Chinese banks and potentially cutting off their access to the dollar, which is basically a death sentence for the international operations of any bank. Now, that is clearly going to be hanging over the talks.
So security in the South China Sea and support for Russia, I mean, these are high-level topics to be broaching on this trip. What can the secretary actually accomplish?
We have discovered by kind of bitter experience that the only two people who can actually save things from a downward spiral towards something very, very frightening are the two top leaders. Everyone's very clear that in this kind of very scratchy, tense moment where the two countries really do not trust each other's motives or ambitions, it's really only the two top leaders that can get stuff done. And so I think to the extent that Antony Blinken can have any headway this week, it's if the Chinese believe that he is delivering a message directly from Joe Biden about all these really important contentious issues. And then you get to all the trade stuff, the economic parts of the competition, which are equally likely to be getting China quite riled up at the moment.
Yeah, I want to get back to a possible meeting between the secretary and Xi Jinping. But I mean, could you imagine China backing down on some of these issues? Would it stop sending weapons components and dual use products to Russia?
China doesn't particularly care who controls this bit of Ukraine or that bit of Ukraine. But they do very much care that America and the West should not inflict a defeat on Vladimir Putin, because for China, everything is ultimately about China, and they would like to see the West divided and weakened by failing in Ukraine. And so they are willing to stand up behind Vladimir Putin.
So there is a lot of suspense about whether Secretary Blinken will meet in a sit-down with Chinese leader Xi Jinping. Why is that? Like, if it were to happen, what would it signify? And if it doesn't, same question.
There is any sense that it's going to be a bad meeting, there's any sense that Xi Jinping is going to kind of hear things he doesn't want to hear, then, you know, they're going to hold against the Americans the possibility that the meeting will not take place. It's one of China's oldest and favorite diplomatic tricks, is to make you so anxious to have the meeting that what you actually get done in the meeting becomes less important than it's simply taking place.
Interesting. You know, in the Cold War era, there was an ideological divide between communism and democracy. These days, though, David, what is the crux of the friction between the U.S. and China?
I think the reason that things are so scratchy and turbulent between the Americans and the Chinese is that it is now very, very clear that they have mutually incompatible ambitions. China's ambitions to essentially push America off the center stage of world affairs and usher in a very different world order in which there is absolutely no value assigned to multi-party democracies. Western values are stripped out of, you know, any multilateral institution, and, you know, China is declared to be every bit as benevolent and democratic a government as America's. That's China's ambition. And there's no way that President Biden can agree to that. And then, in addition, there's this just gigantic economic competition. You remember the talk about a China shock back in the 1990s and 2000s, right, when tons of Chinese goods poured out of factories and sort of sat on the shelves in Walmart. And what we're now facing is what people are talking about, China shock 2.0, because China is now, through, should be said, very hard work and investing and also enormous subsidies, China has become extraordinarily dominant in some very important sectors of the high value-added manufacturing.
Yeah, just look at electric cars, right?
Yeah, and wind turbines. You know, in part, they've made a big bet on dominating the industries that are going to help countries turn green. But it's not just that. It's a whole range of items. They are trying to boost their growth with a gigantic bet on manufacturing. And we are seeing state-owned banks just hosing money at the manufacturing sector, new factories springing up all over China. There isn't enough demand inside China to buy the things those factories are making. It has to go somewhere else. China is trying to rescue its economy by exporting just an absolute tidal wave of cheap, well-made, often high-end manufactured goods. And every rich world market is panicking about the impact on their economies and their jobs. So really, it's an extraordinarily complicated moment. It's hard and it's turbulent, and Antony Blinken's meetings in China are going to be difficult because these are just hard clashes of real economic and strategic national security interests bumping up these two giant countries with very different visions of what they are entitled to and how the world should work.
David Rennie is the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. He spoke with us earlier today from the Chinese capital.
As Rennie said, one possible clash between the U.S. and China could come in the South China Sea. This week in the Philippines, the U.S. military is conducting large-scale military exercises. More than 16,000 American and Filipino service members are participating in the drills aimed at defending Philippine territory, territory that includes islands near China. As the world's Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen reports, that's a move some see as wise and others see as provocative.
Go as far north in the Philippines as possible, and you'll find a place the government's tourism bureau calls mesmerizing.
Every corner stands another wonder. Our own little world away from it all.
That's an ad for the Batanes, a cluster of tiny islands, all smaller than, say, Manhattan. They are green and stunning, but also remote, so they don't actually get many visitors. This week is an exception, though. U.S. and Philippine troops will pour onto one of the islands, pretend it's been invaded, and try to take it back. They'll do an air assault and even bring in, by boat, a HIMARS, a high-mobility artillery rocket system, same as the U.S. sends to Ukraine. It's a big step forward for the U.S.-Philippine military alliance, but some think this is risky business.
The U.S. are making our territory, our seas, as their playground.
France Castro is the deputy minority leader of the Philippines House of Representatives. She notes that the Batanes are only about 350 miles southeast of mainland China. Castro asks, why is the Philippines allowing the U.S. to play war games on these unspoiled islands, practically taunting China? This, she says, is just the start of the U.S. militarizing the Batanes. Details are scarce, but the Philippine government has confirmed the Pentagon is seeking to build a permanent naval port there for its Filipino allies.
this development is very unprecedented. If there would be construction of U.S. military base there, the Philippines would be in a dangerous situation.
Many, including the Philippine president, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., believe the Philippines is already in danger. China's navy is getting bigger and more aggressive. In violation of international law, China did capture a remote island claimed by the Philippines 12 years ago. Today, Chinese forces are still at it, trying to control reefs near the Philippines, leading to recent clashes at sea.
They have had well over a decade of the Chinese taking their territory.
Grant Newsham is a former U.S. Marine colonel who worked in military intelligence. He also wrote the book, When China Attacks. He says it's no wonder the Philippines Navy wants a steady U.S. presence on the Batanes to scare Chinese forces away.
It certainly does need assistance from its friends. Just about everybody needs assistance from their friends if it's the Chinese military that has shown up.
The U.S. has a treaty obligation to defend Philippine soil, including the Batanes. Newsham says the Pentagon will likely push to build out a port that can at least handle U.S. naval destroyers, fast and lethal warships. He believes the U.S. would also want to place missile systems there to strike approaching Chinese warships or targets farther afield.
It would give potentially the ability to strike at China, and it brings, say, the Chinese mainland into easier range from ground-based missiles, for example.
One huge reason the U.S. is so interested in the Batanes, they're only about 100 miles south of Taiwan, the democratic U.S.-backed island that China claims and threatens to seize. Newsham says U.S. forces on the Batanes could help thwart a Chinese amphibious invasion of Taiwan.
It's not a checkmate, but it does make things more difficult if you're going to go after Taiwan.
Beijing warns the Philippines, don't let the U.S. exploit you. Militarizing the Batanes Islands is, quote, playing with fire. Representative France Castro is no fan of Beijing, but does take its threats to heart. She says the Philippines is getting sucked into an inter-imperialist war and doesn't trust the U.S. to be honest about its intentions in the Batanes.
We wouldn't know. We wouldn't know what are they doing. We even don't know what equipments, military materials they are placing there. So that is very, very worrisome.
But she is in the minority. Recent polls show 8 in 10 Filipinos favor cooperating with the U.S. military to protect their seas. In the exercises kicking off this week, U.S. and Philippine forces will also, for the first time, venture west beyond the Philippines' territory into international waters claimed by China. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
An update now to a story we've been following in the Middle East. The Palestinian militant group Hamas put out a video today showing 23-year-old American Israeli hostage Hirsch Goldberg Polan speaking to the camera. It's not clear when it was recorded. In it, Goldberg Polan says he's been held captive for nearly 200 days, suggesting that it was filmed quite recently. His parents, John Polan and Rachel Goldberg, have been outspoken advocates for their son and other hostages still held in Gaza. Today, the couple released their own video saying they're relieved to see their son, Hirsch, alive.
We heard your voice today for the first time in 201 days. And if you can hear us, I am telling you, we are telling you, we love you, stay strong, survive.
The couple again called on all the parties involved in negotiations to reach a deal to free the hostages. You can listen to my recent conversation with John Polan and Rachel Goldberg in Jerusalem. That's online at theworld.org. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Kenya, staff at public hospitals have been on strike for more than 40 days, and it's impacting the country's healthcare system. Local news media in Kenya are reporting that some patients are dying as a result of the ongoing strike. Union representatives and government officials are blaming each other for the impasse. From the capital, Nairobi, The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gakande reports.
On Tuesday, about 100 health workers stood outside the gates of the Ministry of Health building in Nairobi, including union leader George Gibore, the general secretary of the Kenya Union of Clinical Officers, which is one of several unions on strike right now that includes doctors, dentists, and clinicians. At the heart of their complaints is what they say is the government's failure to live up to the terms of prior collective bargaining agreements. He tells me they have already tried going to court over this.
So our strike purely is more of enhancement or enforcement, enforcing the court order which are in place.
Some of the issues covered by the agreements are pay and staffing in public hospitals. Gibore says right now, health workers are overworked and overwhelmed, and this is hurting the quality of health care being given to patients in public facilities. Another major issue in this strike is a new decision by the government to cut the salaries of medical interns from the equivalent of around $1,500 per month to a stipend of about $500 a month. That's barely livable, says fourth-year medical student Bonfas Mbilo.
Being paid less than somebody who's watching over the gate is kind of a humiliation while I'm 24 hours I'm at the hospital.
On Monday night, government officials said they were close to reaching a deal with one union to end the strike, but it fell through. Government official Anne Wairimu had strong words for medical workers yesterday.
The doctors are therefore insensitive to the suffering and plight of the vulnerable Kenyans in dire need of health services.
She said that they are working to address some of the concerns of medical workers, including paying off the equivalent of millions of dollars in salary arrears at public hospitals. But she said they need to balance their demands with the fiscal reality of the country. Right now, Kenya's president, William Ruto, has prioritized making fiscal reforms to address Kenya's debt crisis.
Our friends, the doctors, that we mind about them, we value the service they give to our nation, but we must live within our means.
But critics argue that the government isn't investing enough in the health sector. For some, these strikes have become the latest class issue in Kenya. Mbagathi Hospital in Nairobi is one of the public hospitals impacted by the strike. CEO Alex Irongo tells me how many of their patients come from the city's largest slum.
The people that we serve as a public facility are the ones on the down of the pyramid in the society.
He tells me that only around 30% of medical officers are working right now because of the strike. As I walk through the hospital, I see how some of the wards are nearly empty. Irongo tells me only about a third of the normal number of patients are coming through their doors right now.
Where are the other people going? Because it doesn't mean that they got well overnight. So where are they going? It means they are not coming to hospital.
The strike is putting a huge burden on the doctors who are still working, either because they are already pensioned or work in management or are on pre-existing contracts, like Dr. Patrick Umuga, an intern. He tells me they are currently working 24-hour shifts.
Some departments where there are consultants are not available, so we can't attend to all the cases. So most of the cases we refer because there is no consultant to attend to them.
Refer to other hospitals, including private ones, but not everyone can afford to go to them.
You really feel sad when a patient has come who really needs help, but you are unable to give the particular help he needs.
At the same time, he wants government officials to come see the state of public hospitals for themselves. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Nairobi.
Italy and olive oil. For foodies, the reputation is well-deserved, but in recent years, Italy's olive trees have been ravaged by a bacterium called Xylella fastidiosa. That bacteria was accidentally imported, and it provides an example for how Europe handles pathogens that sneak a ride on imported goods. We asked Wopke van der Werf to explain more. He's an agricultural ecologist at Wageningen University in the Netherlands.
The plant responds by making gum. It doesn't like those bacteria there. It's not used to those bacteria. It's not pre-adapted. So it makes the gum, and then there's no water transport anymore, and then the tree dies because of lack of water.
So this disease, this bacterium, Xylella, it's not found on the European continent. So how did it reach Italy?
It's believed that it probably got there through ornamental plants, coffee plants that were brought in because they look nice. Then somehow this bacterium was transported from such plants to other hosts, and Xylella has a lot of host plants.
Mm. And those ornamental coffee trees that you believe might have carried this bacterium, where do they come from?
I think they originally came from somewhere in Middle America, and it came through the Netherlands because we are a big hub in import and export of plant material.
Do we know how it then gets to the olive trees?
This bacterium is vectored, so it needs little insects, sharpshooters, to be transported. So they feed on the xylem, they take up the bacterium, they can go to a new plant and transmit it. It's transported from one plant to another, and eventually it gets into an olive tree. It's an unlikely thing to happen, but if you try it over and over again, like with car accidents, I've not had a car accident my whole life because the chance is small. But if you have a whole population of people driving cars, car accidents happen every day. It's a certainty that it happened.
How often does this happen in Europe, that a foreign pathogen enters and devastates plants and crops? And is there any way to prevent it?
This kind of thing happens at a regular basis. It's usually not as bad as with Xylella. Xylella is the worst case that we've had in many years. But there are many cases of foreign pathogens and pests that come in that cause an outbreak. And then the national plant protection agencies get in to limit the spread and, if possible, eradicate it. So they're really trying very hard and oftentimes successful, but not always successful. And sometimes they're really too late.
So the job falls to national plant protection agencies.
They do the work, but because Europe is, we have the European Union, so there is coordination between what member states should do, because within Europe, there's free trade. So within Europe, there's no barrier, so plant material can be moved freely, fruit, vegetables, everything. So what enters into Italy can become a problem in the Netherlands, and what enters in the Netherlands can go to any place in Europe.
I mean, what kind of controls are there for agricultural products to enter Europe?
There is import inspection. So product that comes in is inspected by inspectors, open boxes, take samples. If they find something that they don't think is right, they send it to a laboratory to see what it is. These people have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, but as we see with Xylella, some bacteriums slip through, right?
Definitely. And I think it slipped through because Xylella, at the time that it did slip through, was, as far as I'm aware, not on the radar. So it was not specifically checked.
Are the kind of outbreaks that have devastated Italy's olive trees occurring more frequently?
I think they're more frequent. And I think it's a combination of increasing trade and transport and people moving from one place to another. And we also see that with climate change, territories that were previously too cool for certain organisms to establish have now become warmer. So certain pests and pathogens that were not a risk, say 30 years ago, are a risk now because it's simply warmer.
Wopke van der Werf at Wageningen University in the Netherlands there. You're with the world.
Students in Argentina are protesting budget cuts to education. Don't steal the next generation's future, they say. Not everyone sees it that way.
The government has run out of external financing, and there is a need to cut the budget deficit, and that includes education.
Plus, getting new citizens to vote in Arizona. Those stories and more still ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The group that calls itself the Islamic State no longer holds any significant territory in the Middle East, but it is still capable of carrying out large-scale operations. ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack in a Moscow theater last month that killed about 130 people. One strategy to try to contain ISIS has been to hold thousands of people in detention camps in northeastern Syria. Authorities allege that the detainees are tied to the extremist group. The World's Shirin Jafari recently visited some of these camps to speak with detainees. Over the next 3 days, she's going to bring us some of their stories and the debates surrounding their fate. Shirin, ISIS, as I said, doesn't hold much territory anymore, but it is still active. What kind of capabilities does it have?
Yeah, you know, Caroline, for a lot of people, ISIS is the story of the past. It's not making headlines anymore like it did between 2014 and 2019, so it must be over. But the reality is that today ISIS has branches in different parts of the world. The attack in Russia, for example, which you mentioned, was carried out by an ISIS affiliate in Afghanistan called ISIS-K. So even though the US-led coalition defeated ISIS in Syria and Iraq between 2017 and 2019, the group continues to be active and to carry out attacks. And just a quick background here, ISIS members follow jihadi Salafist ideology, which is a Sunni fundamentalist movement. ISIS fighters captured territory in Iraq and Syria, and they established what they called a caliphate, which is an Islamic society run by Sharia law.
All right, so in Syria specifically these days, what kind of reach does the group have based on your reporting there on the ground?
There are these groups called sleeper cells, which continue to carry out attacks on local residents. For example, when I was in Syria last month, ISIS killed a group of farmers just outside of Raqqa, which is a city in northern Syria where I was staying. And besides these sleeper cells, there are roughly 60,000 people with suspected ISIS ties held in about 24 detention camps and rehabilitation facilities across northeastern Syria. Most of them are Syrians and Iraqis, but a portion of them are foreigners who came to Syria from Europe and elsewhere. These are people who are believed to have some sort of connection to ISIS, and it's a wide variety of people. You have those who actually supported and fought for ISIS, and others who just happened to live under ISIS, or they were born there. And as the world moved on from defeating ISIS in Syria, these people were sort of forgotten. And we, as Americans, should care, not just because it's a humanitarian issue, but also because our government funds and supports these camps and detention centers.
Mm. So 60,000 people in these detention centers, that's a lot of people. Who is running these camps?
So the Kurdish administration that controls northeastern Syria oversees these camps. But according to a report by Amnesty International that was released just last week, the U.S. is involved in most aspects of the detention system. It funds everything from building these facilities to repairing them and training security guards for them. Some of the detainees told Amnesty International that they were tortured and mistreated. I asked the State Department about this, and they said that they are concerned about these reports of human rights abuses and that they urge countries to take back their citizens.
I gather that the people in these camps are often described as ISIS suspects. What is the legal status of those detainees?
The majority of them haven't been charged or convicted, partly because it's so hard to establish that someone was an ISIS member, unless there is some sort of evidence like videos of them participating in ISIS propaganda or fighting for the group. And as a result, many have been living in these camps for almost a decade. Some countries have repatriated their citizens. Iraq, for example, has taken some people back. So have a few other countries, including the U.S. But there are thousands of people, again, mostly women and children, whose future remain unclear. This is how Thanasi Kambanis described it to me. He's the director of Century International, which is a progressive think tank based in New York.
It's like a Guantanamo on an epic scale to have this many people who are basically told that the plan is forever for them and their kids to live without any legal status, and they've neither been convicted of any crimes, nor in many cases are they even allowed to get passports to the countries they're from.
He compares these camps to Guantanamo, but of course the difference here is that in the case of Syria, there are thousands of women and children who are locked up. For this series, we're going to start at the biggest camp called Al-Hol, and we're going to hear how residents are coping with conditions there. About 10 miles west of the Iraqi border sits the sprawling camp called Al-Hol, named after a nearby town. After passing miles of empty green plains, a few checkpoints guarded by armed men, suddenly you come face to face with a metropolis.
I see the camp.
Yeah, you can see the camp. A lot of checkpoints. They have some security procedures.
This is my interpreter, Mohammad Hassan. There are rows upon rows of white tents, some bearing the logos of the United Nations Refugee Agency. barbed wire, and watchtowers separate the camp from the outside world. Men in military uniforms guard the entrance, their faces covered with balaclavas, their guns slung on their shoulders. A badge on their uniforms read, ISIS Hunters. They ask for our papers.
Sahafa.
Sahafa?
A few minutes later, we are waved through. We're assigned two armed guards. Journalists can't walk around here without protection. Violence is part of daily life, one camp official tells me. Sometimes residents with more radical views and stronger support for ISIS want to impose their ideology on others, she says. And then there's the issue of crime and personal disputes. In 2021, the charity Save the Children described this place as one of the most dangerous in the world. Security has improved somewhat since then, camp officials say. On the surface, life goes on. There's a market where you can find everything from fresh herbs to hair dye and nail clippers. Women wearing black from head to toe inspect the products. Their faces are covered, but some have a look of exhaustion in their eyes. About half of the 40,000 people who live here are children, according to the United Nations. One woman holding a baby girl approaches and tells me her daughter has been sick for days. An older man complains about the lack of health care at the camp. These are not comfortable living conditions by any means. In the summer, temperatures rise to more than 100 degrees and the tents have no cooling system. Since the start of Israel's war in Gaza, militia groups in Iraq have targeted American forces based in Syria. They oppose the U.S.'s support for Israel. These attacks have once again raised questions about whether the U.S. should remain in Syria. Jinan Hanna is with the administration in charge of Al-Hol camp. She says a U.S. departure would cause a lot of problems. ISIS is not gone, she tells me. They are still active in the camps and outside. We, the Kurds, are guarding our enemy, she says. Right now, if you ask a small kid here who is your enemy, he will say the Kurds. She goes on to say that the Kurds have fought shoulder to shoulder with the Americans against ISIS, and that protecting these camps is the human and ethical thing to do. We leave Jinan Hanna at Al-Hol to visit a resident at the second largest camp in northeastern Syria. Raj holds about 3,000 foreign families of ISIS. 65% of them are children, according to the United Nations. There are women and children here from South Africa, the U.S. and the U.K., as well as others. Wajda lived in Al-Hol for 3 years before being transferred to Raj camp about a year ago.
I have never, ever done anything to hurt anybody, anywhere.
Wajda didn't want me to use her full name in this story or provide specific details of her past because she says she has pending legal cases. She says she was born and raised in the UK and then moved to the city of Baghouz in Syria. We speak inside her tent as the rain pounds on. Her tent is dark and damp. On one side, there's all kitchen equipment, pots and pans.
I got injured in Baghouz. Yes.
With airstrikes.
The airstrike was somewhere else, and I was just, I had my ass.
There was an explosion near where she was, she says. A shrapnel cut through her back.
I was in a coma. I could talk normal. I could walk normal.
After 3 weeks in a coma, Wajda woke up to learn that she was partially paralyzed. She couldn't remember some names, she says. Her speech was slurred. To this day, she says, she suffers from pain. She apologizes frequently for talking slowly. As we speak, her 7-year-old son flips open the entrance to the tent.
Do you want your cap?
Hold on 1 second, let me get it for you.
It's my raining cap.
It's your raining cap. Her son, whom she asked that I not name, was born under ISIS. She says he's only known a life of fear, displacement and stigma. She doesn't let him play outside much. It's too dangerous, she says.
I really want to go home so he can start a school, have friends. He's my son, so I want the best for him.
Do you have hope of ever leaving here?
Yes. I have to have hope. Because if I don't have hope, I will be depressed.
Several countries have taken back their citizens, including the U.S., but many still remain here in limbo.
No one wants to take these people back.
That's Thanasi Kambanis again, the Middle East expert at Century International.
And we end up with this very jury-rigged arrangement where the U.S., working with Syrian Kurds, has set up a statelet whose main strategic benefit to the U.S. and to many others is that it acts as an indefinite holding pen for all these ISIS people.
Kambanis says, sure, some of these people are genuinely committed ISIS members. They believe in the ideology, and some of them even look forward to having another chance to establish a caliphate.
But this is how society works. We don't get to just park in a twilight zone 50 or 65,000 people who have beliefs that we don't like.
Countries should set up a process, he says, to identify criminals among the camp population, to charge and prosecute them in court. Outside Rajda's tent, the rain hasn't stopped the kids from playing. As we get ready to leave, they suddenly spot a plane flying above, likely an American one, given the proximity of the camp to American bases. They wave, and one of them yells that maybe the plane will swoop down and rescue his friend from the camp. They all laugh, and the iron gates close behind us. For The World, Shirin Jafari, northeastern Syria.
Tomorrow on the show, we hear from a young man who says his stepfather took him to live under ISIS in Syria.
When I was back home, I didn't know there was a country called Syria, you know. I didn't know anything about what's going on.
The story of Sule Sue tomorrow on The World.
Currently in the U.S., naturalized citizens make up 10% of the electorate. In fact, wanting to vote is what motivates a lot of people to get citizenship. In swing states like Arizona, that group could have a significant impact on how this year's election turns out. KJZZ's Elisa Resnick met some of the state's newest eligible voters preparing to cast their first ever ballots.
When Tucson resident Ricardo Morales set out to get his U.S. citizenship last year, he had one big reason in mind.
The elections, because I know that the elections were coming, so that was one of my main goals.
He's a community organizer with the advocacy group Chicanos por la Causa. Today, that message is the same one he gives to others looking into the process.
Just do it. I mean, if you can apply for citizenship, do it, register to vote, and participate. I mean, this is part of the civic education that all the immigrants we should have.
He says people want to get their citizenship for a lot of different reasons. But more and more, he's hearing from immigrants like him who want to do it so they can vote.
Like people is telling me, oh, I want to be able to vote. I want to register. I want to make myself heard.
That's exactly what Morales and others set out to help people do last month in Nogales. A few dozen participants filed into a community center to hear from immigration experts and advocacy groups about everything from the cost of applying to language requirements to take the test. It was the first ever citizenship resource fair in Nogales put on by Chicanos por la Causa, and it went over the barriers and benefits of becoming naturalized. Nogales resident Isidra Aguirre says she came to get some of those questions answered. She's been in town for over a decade, and she says getting her citizenship would be a chance to finally have a voice in what happens where she lives. Because right now, we can't decide, she says. We can't vote. She says she wants to become a citizen for a lot of reasons. But above all, it's to vote and get a chance to decide on who's in the government. According to the American Immigration Council's report this year, some 164,000 immigrants are eligible for naturalization in Arizona alone. Report co-author Steve Hubbard notes that President Biden won Arizona in 2020 with far fewer votes.
And the margin of victory in Arizona was 10,000, almost 11,000.
Plus, he says getting citizenship is a long and rigorous process. That means those that complete it are likely to exercise their new rights and make an impact at the polls.
So it is a population that I think, you know, politicians, wherever you are, should be thinking about. because they are probably very much a likely voter.
That message was a central theme at a special naturalization ceremony held at a Tucson elementary school in March.
I'd like to recognize the countries of origin that our new citizens represent.
The presiding judge recognized 23 new U.S. citizens from more than a dozen countries. They were greeted with a folklorico performance and speeches from local leaders, including Tucson Mayor Rino Romero.
Our democracy may be imperfect, but it is resilient. And so it becomes our job, your job, to work together towards perfecting our democracy. And that is the essence of what being a citizen is all about.
And just outside the ceremony, representatives from the Pima County Recorder's Office were waiting to help register new citizens as voters, like Alavira Doherty.
I am from here in Tucson, actually. I live here in Tucson, and my kids all came here to school. But I am from Tonga Island. So today, I become the American citizen.
Doherty's been in Tucson for more than 30 years with a green card. She says getting her citizenship makes her feel like a whole new person with new opportunities. And as far as voting in November?
Definitely, definitely. Because believe me, I do believe, not just for me, my family, but my whole community.
For The World, I'm Alisa Resnick in Tucson, Arizona.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires, people flooded into the streets on Tuesday. Demonstrators carried banners saying, "Don't steal the next generation's future." That's because Argentina's new president, Javier Milei, has imposed an austerity budget that has, among other things, left the country's free public universities without enough money to run. Martin Castellano has been following this story. He's the head of Latin American research at the Institute of International Finance in Washington. Martin, let's start with the cuts for universities that inspired these recent protests. What is the president's rationale for freezing the education budget right now during a time of inflation?
Yeah, so it's not just the education budget. It's just a significant fiscal adjustment that is underway because the country was and it's still in a very critical situation. Macroeconomic conditions are very tough. The government has run out of external financing, and there is a need to cut the budget deficit, the fiscal deficit. And that includes improving revenues and also cutting fiscal spending, and that includes education.
So trade unions have also joined in on these protests. As you said, it's not just education that's getting cut. But Milei seems to be ignoring this pushback. He told the press yesterday that this is the first quarter with a financial surplus since 2008. What is the importance of that? What point is he trying to make there?
Well, he's trying to make the point that he needs to stabilize the economy first, and that includes reducing external financing needs. So fiscal adjustment is the core of his program. The goal is reducing inflation. Inflation is running at still very high levels, even though it has declined in recent months. And then activity is also declining as a result of the lack of financing. So the main goal is stabilizing macroeconomic conditions. At the same time, he's also pushing for more sort of microeconomic reforms. That includes reducing the size of the state, eliminating regulations, and providing more scope for the private sector to operate. And that includes also cutting spending in several areas, including education. I think Milei now needs to score some sort of political victory in the coming months because public support has been strong so far. But as we have seen this week, it has started to erode. So he needs to score a political victory in the coming months. Otherwise, we could see more social unrest.
And what is the inflation rate in Argentina?
Well, inflation rates, it's running at around 10% month over month.
And what about annually? It's much higher, right?
Yeah. So looking at annual numbers, we have a forecast, for instance, 170% end of the year inflation. And so far, it's running at 280.
Wow. And how does Argentina compare economically with its neighbors? Are these problems being experienced across the region?
When you look at macroeconomic policies, the region is already at a different stage. Inflation is well below 5% in most countries. Countries have independent central banks with inflation targeting regimes that are highly credible. Fiscal positions are, even though we have seen imbalances in other countries, Brazil, Colombia, and others, there is a fiscal framework in place. So macroeconomic stability is not at risk in those countries. In Argentina, there is a long way in order to get there. And then these discussions about education and some of the social needs, microeconomic reforms, they have always been in place. Education, it's a very sensitive issue, I would say, and public education in particular in Latin America. We have seen protests in the past in Chile and in other countries as well related to that. So I think it's a very sensitive issue. And when you put that together with a program that requires significant fiscal adjustment, other corrective measures, just in order to reduce inflation and stabilize the economy, that's not a good combination.
When he was inaugurated, didn't Milei tell people that these economic reforms would be painful? Is he just, you know, following through on his promises and what he thinks is the right course?
Yes. And public support, even though the corrective measures from the very beginning of his administration, public support for the government has so far remained strong. That has allowed Milei to maintain a very confrontational stance, confronting with the opposition, even its closest political allies. And he has been very, very proactive in terms of putting together stabilization measures. The key thing to watch is to see rapid disinflation in the coming months. So lower inflation should help ease pressure on real wages, so improve purchasing power, also on the exchange rate, and that would help the government accumulate more dollars. So that's very important to see rapid disinflation, that there is some light at the end of the tunnel in order to maintain popular support. And discussing the education budget at this point, given all the needs in terms of macroeconomic stabilization, do not help, in my view, at this stage.
Martin Castellano is head of Latin American research at the Institute of International Finance in Washington. He was updating us on austerity measures in Argentina that have drawn some protesters into the streets over cuts to education.
It is one of those stories you might not believe if you didn't see the video.
At least four people have been injured and taken to hospital after escaped military horses bolted through central London during the morning rush hour.
That's right. Five horses from a British military unit were apparently spooked by construction noise in London and took off at a gallop. It happened during a rehearsal at Buckingham Palace for the King's birthday parade, which is scheduled for June. One horse crashed into a bus, another into a taxi.
A witness who gave his name as Sean and said he drives a taxi called into the BBC to give his account from the scene.
Three horses went past me at full gallop without riders, which obviously was quite extraordinary. So nudged out a little bit more to check it was safe to pull out. And then another horse came around the corner with a rider on it and just missed my cab.
Sean went on to say he saw two cavalry riders on the ground, a smashed van with blood on its side, and a black BMW with its window and rear end destroyed. By the time he did the radio interview, Sean said the cabbie network already knew the horses had been caught.
Cavalry horses, as they're called, often take a prominent role in ceremonies with the British royals. They're not supposed to be spooked by anything. They're trained for months on the city streets, so they get used to heavy traffic and loud noises, including gun salutes and military bands, and you would presume construction noises.
An army spokesman says all the horses were returned to their barracks and are undergoing veterinary care. Three soldiers went to the hospital with injuries that are not life-threatening. A fourth person was injured, a member of the public, who happened to be cycling when the animals got loose.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. You be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.